Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is Sheldon Green. Sheldon, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
Maybe we could start with a little background. Who is Sheldon Green?
Well, I'm kind of a guy that has a lot of different hats, and I'm a lawyer, work in the financial area. I'm also an executive in a wind energy company, and had a long history kind of trying to being an iconoclast in taking down people like Ronald Reagan when they were violating other people's rights in areas like immigration and health. And most recently, I'm a strong kind of Democrat and participant, was a participant early on in Obama's national policy teams for energy and for immigration. And among other things, write novels, as you know. That's kind of a thumbnail sketch.
I believe you sing as well, don't you?
Yeah, right. I sing in the Oakland Symphony Chorus. In fact, we just finished two performances of Beethoven's Ninth, Sunday and Friday. They were a real high.
I mean, I'm amazed. You do so many things. How on earth do you fit it into the 24-hour day?
Well, for me, it's something the way I've always been that way. I've always been multitask, and I'm not obsessive or compulsive about anything. I'm just kind of, I have a seamless life. Whatever interests me, I do. People say, well, do you sit down and write at a certain time? And I don't. I do whatever I have to do on any given day. And I try to devote that the same kind of energy to the practice of law, kind of in a Zen way, or writing, that I do to singing or gardening. It's just, I try to create a holistic life. My formula, frankly, is kind of probably a banal statement, but it summarizes it. I figure you only come one way, one time through this this life, and I want to get my money's worth, so do as many things I can.
I love that. I mean, that is one of the finest statements I've ever heard. You know, you only hear once, I want to get my money's worth. I do hope you won't mind if I quote you on that one.
No, not at all. Feel free. You don't have to give me attribution either. You can take it yourself.
You have three books in print, and I want to tell you that I like every one of them. Every one of them is an absolutely fabulous read. You've done an outstanding job.
Well, I appreciate your feelings. Obviously, that kind of attitude is what makes me feel that it was all worthwhile. Although I probably would have done it for myself anyhow. So.
In typical Simon Barrett fashion, you know, I review a book and then I go, I like this. So I tend to work backwards. So the latest book that I read was actually the first book that you wrote, Lost and Found. I believe it was originally published in
81. Yeah.
And then republished in 2004?
Right.
Yeah. Did you rework it, or
no.
Was it...
Oh, no.
No?
Mm-mm.
Huh.
No, it's exactly as it was. It was published by Random House originally, and then republished by iUniverse.
Tell us a little bit about the plot, without giving away too many spoilers.
Well, the premise of the book is that a very kind of quiet guy who comes to a small town in western Pennsylvania as a refugee from World War II, has an opportunity to go to Israel to find his only relative, a cousin, and he gets reparations there. So he has an opportunity to look at his life in this little town, Bolton, Pennsylvania, and in the context of it, he explores various life experiences and episodes of all the very ordinary people that live in the town, and obviously concludes that this is where he's found his roots and his life. But in the context of it, the idea of the book was really to explore the nature of the way we, in this world, human beings interact, and the way in which they deal with the past, and the way in which they deal with conflict, and then to take that down a little bit and to use the American middle class in middle America, and to use the Jewish community as a microcosm. So that's what the premise of the book was. And so it explores many different issues, the issues that interest me that we can talk about.
You set it in a town that no one's ever heard of. Ooh, I'm sorry, but there's probably someone listening in from Bolton who's going to say, whoa, that's not right. But, I mean, why did you choose, you know, a small town rather than a larger metropolis?
Well, for one thing, I think that the small town is an easier place to create a microcosm. And particularly because you have a Jewish community that's relatively cohesive. It's easy to identify. The characters come up stronger, and so that was really what I wanted to do. But what I was also doing, it was the small town that my grandmother lived in, that my mother was born in. And so I understood that town, and I understood characters in the town, I thought. So it seemed to me to be a good microcosm. The first description of the town that you've probably read is actually the description of the town as I would see it as a child coming to Butler, Pennsylvania, which is what the town is actually named, a little place about 30 miles north of Pittsburgh.
That's delightful. I read lots of works of fiction, and I get to talk to lots and lots of authors, and when inevitably after you strip the veneer off, you find that there are elements of truth in the story.
Yeah, I think everything's referential, but I can assure you that the characters are all really they're imaginative characters. There's no individual except for one. There's a lady that has a dream, and she comes up, I think, the kite, if you remember that.
And yes.
It was really based upon one of my great aunts. I mean, not what happened to her, but the character of her, that kind of patrician image.
Right. I found Lost and Found to be a very, very cohesive story, yet it's also a collection of vignettes. It's the kind of book that you can sit down and just read three or four pages, enjoy it, put it down, think about it, and come back later, pick it up, and there's yet another little story. Was that your aim?
Yes, exactly. I was impressed. Actually, the model that I used was Isaac Babel's Red Cavalry Tales. I mean, it has nothing to do with this book, but it's one guy who is narrating a lot of different episodes that are related to a common theme, and it ties all together in the book. And that's what I was striving to do. And then there's I'll kind of give you another insight of what happens. When Jackie Farber bought the book at Random House, she said, don't change a word of it, but give it a plot. So at the time, it was the episodes. And so in 6 weeks, I decided, okay, I'm going to structure something that ties it together more, because that's what she asked for, which is this sequence of his questioning of whether or not he should leave town and or whether he should stay there because of the reparations possibility. So I expanded the book by about a third in 6 weeks, and she looked at that and said, don't change a word. And that's how the book came about.
No, I mean, it truly is amazing. As a reviewer, my tendency, you know, is to sit outside on my front porch, you know, enjoy the world, and start at page one and read till I reach the back cover. And some books you have to do that with, because you tend to lose the thread. This is a book that is just delightful. I did read it in one sitting, by the way, but I could see how, you know, you could just pick it up and almost open the pages at random and you know, find some, you know, tale. Some are humorous, some are serious. Really, a collection of wonderful, wonderful vignettes.
Well, thank you. There are a lot of, some of them that mean more to me, obviously, but they're all my attempt to illustrate some point that I think is valid about our American experience.
Indeed. And I know that much of the book is of a very, very serious nature, but that there are other parts of it that just have some wonderful humor. The story you tell about the authentic Jewish cookbook has to be one of the best. I mean, literally, I was just laughing out loud, and the tears were rolling down my face. Would you like to, you know, share a précis of that particular story?
Yeah, sure. And it's it really is actually humorous and intended to be lighthearted and humorous. But the fact is, it's a very serious point that everybody's got their. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, because I hit the speaker. Everybody's got their own idea of the past and what it should be. And it's really more nostalgia than reality. But the fact is that that it gets reified. Everybody thinks that their idea of the past is the way the past is. I could extend that beyond and look at all the various conflicts we have in the world over people's definition of reality. So that's really what was going on. But it's a better illustration to put it in a very lighthearted vein and to say that nobody can really come up with a common recipe for something simple as a tortilla or a blintz. And as you know, the analysis by the people who were talking about the Jewish cookbook, there were even people who thought that that the tortilla is proof that the Jewish people in fact came at the time of Solomon and settled and acculturated the New World. So that's pretty much the way we are as human beings, and yet in that little episode, it's both amusing and poignant.
Well, what I loved was the punchline, where the original author of the cookbook is a great cook, but can't actually manage to cobble together a recipe. So there's a competition. It's a blind taste test,
right?
And the lady that wins, wins unanimously. And when asked, were these family recipes? Oh no, I got them straight out of a cookery book.
That's reality, I think.
I'm not joking. I had to put the book down at that point. I was going, oh my, what a great, great line. But the Lost and Found is also operates on a much more serious level. The bookstore story.
Yeah, the bookstore. For me, is one of the most important things, and it's actually the thing that the New York Times reviewer really loved about the book. And that's connected. The point that I'm making in the bookstore, first of all, is that the Holocaust kind of swept away an enormous, like a tidal wave, all of the culture and all of the traditions, and what was left was something very superficial and shallow. And that shallowness is pretty much what was embraced by the contemporary community. And the bookstore tells a couple of critical stories. I mean, one, it's got all of these arcane books which were collected by this very reclusive guy who claims to have been the last of the Monongahessett Indians of that town and claims that the culture and the books came down from early Monongahessett Indians who had communication in earlier times with people all over the world. But in any event, the bookstore is really ignored by the community, and the only people that are interested in the bookstore is a family who are secret Canaanites. And if you know biblical history, the Canaanites were the people that got displaced by the Jews when they came back from their slavery in Egypt. So when the Jews were celebrating certain events because they were momentous, like Passover, the secret family of the Canaanites were actually mourning, etc. So if I can, I just read one passage of describing the bookstore.
Oh, certainly.
Okay?
Oh, be my guest.
Okay. It was like a wilderness. The placement of the manuscripts had no apparent order, arranged neither by title, author, nor subject matter. It may be that Shabtai, that's the owner, knew the order. It may be that the key to the order of the volumes would unlock some profound secret of the essence of life, although Shabtai, by his demeanor, gave no hint of it as he rummaged among the stacks and piles, walking from here to there, picking things up, then putting them down after a moment's reflection, muttering to himself. If there was any universal truth in the order of the place, it was that chaos and disorder were the only rules of life. But that conclusion was too obvious. No, there had to be either something more profound or simply nothing at all. And as you know, the bookstore burns, and nobody really appreciates that. They're more concerned with some event that occurs in the newspaper until a scholar comes, a preeminent scholar, comes to town to look it up and finds that it's gone, and he tells the rabbi that this was the most priceless collection of Judaica in the world, and that kind of tells the story, and it's what I'm saying, kind of in a prophetic way, telling people are not really deep enough about our past. We deal with it superficially. The Dachau story connects to that, and the reason...
Before we get on to Dachau, the bookstore, there's one line in there talking about how reclusive the owner is, and I thought it was wonderful the way you included the little piece of, I guess, minutia, you know, about kids who, you know, looked through a crack in the fence and that they could see that he had a vegetable garden.
Oh. Interesting. I appreciate that observation.
No, he didn't go out. He didn't socialize.
Yeah.
I think the term hermit probably springs to mind. But the local kids, you know, they had done their research, you know, peering through. You know, the Dachau story is a subject that, in fact, it's about the only subject I can think of that does actually run through all three of your books.
Right. It does, and it as a an example of the Holocaust. Yeah, the Dachau story in this book is the book it really pushed people's buttons, and it deals as you know with a couple of people from town that go to Europe on a holiday, and they get in a rainstorm and they get lost, and they end up at a tavern, and the people are very hospitable there. And they spend the night, and the next morning they find that they have been staying outside of Dachau, which people know is a notorious German concentration camp. And if I can, I'd just like to read what they see the next morning, and then tell you about their reaction and the impact of that.
Sure.
The early morning light suffused the clearing mist with a purity, a total absence of color. Steve awoke and was drawn again to the window. There across the road, beyond a hedge of trees, still spectral in the undulating morning mist, were several long white barn-like buildings on one side of a vast empty field, empty except for the outlines of foundations and a gravel road dividing it. On the far side of the field, the top of a chimney protruded from a grove of trees, and nearby were several shapes that looked like monumental sculptures. As Steve watched, a milky film enveloped everything, and there was nothing to see but a void, chaos as it must have been before life came to the universe. A compost of souls covering a barren world. But Steve saw only a heavy mist, closing off a monument so abstracted that it conveyed no feeling to him. And that pushed the button of the New York Times reviewer. He said, oh, well, at least we would have gone to and prayed. And, in fact, coincidentally, that same year that this book was published, they started planning the National Holocaust Museum and several other monuments that were commemorating the Holocaust in the United States. Because what I was saying there was that the real meaning of the Holocaust has been repressed by the community, which pretty much lives in the present. So now you ask about how it ties to the other books, and I really love to tie things together that way. So in Burnt Umber, as you recall, the first artist that's there is a real artist, Franz Marc.
Right.
And the book starts up, and Franz Marc, and this is before World War One, and Franz Marc and Kandinsky, his buddy, are on their way to visit one of their mentors, a German landscape painter named Holder. And they go past the kind of dark Moorish landscapes on the way to Dachau, because that's where he lives. And so Dachau finds its way both as this very picturesque village before World War One, and later on toward the end of the book when the other artist, the Harold Paris artist,
Don't you call him Harold Bear?
I call him Harry Bear, yeah. But, I mean, he's really based upon a real artist who spent most of his life sculpting at UC Berkeley, as you know, from the story, as well as in Paris before that. So you have him experiencing the Holocaust in the real concentration camp and having impact on his work. So that's the Dachau connection in that book. And then in Prodigal Sons, which is post-war and in Munich, where you have the hero of the book who's come back to Germany to take revenge on Nazis that have escaped the denazification net. And he is an art historian, as you know, and he's dealing with his handler, takes him through a museum because he's working as an art curator, that's his, at the museum. And he takes him through a room of landscapes, 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century German landscapes, and they stop to look at a painting by Holder. And it's the same painting that Franz Marc and Kandinsky are essentially a landscape are passing on their way to see Holder when he's alive in this picturesque village. So that's how I kind of connect the Dachau runs through all three of these books.
I'm going to come back to the art aspect because I know there is one. But going back to Lost and Found, that there's another wonderful, wonderful piece of writing, the infamous speaking engagement. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites as well. Actually, it's favorite because it's such a passionate situation. In that situation, you've got the hero of the book, Mendel, who's invited to the Pittsburgh Community Center to talk about his life in this little, in this town, Jamosk, in Poland, before World War II. And so he's somewhat shy about that, but he prepares, and he goes to the community center, and only two people show up to listen to his lecture. And he thinks they're elderly Jewish people, and so he finds out later on when they drift off and send him a letter that in fact they are Polish Catholics who were interested in the nostalgia of Poland before the war. And nobody from the Jewish community shows up. Well, okay, people can say, oh, aren't you being a little harsh? The fact is that at one point I had written the things that predated Lost and Found called Two Lost Tribes. And I was invited to the San Francisco Jewish Community Center to speak. And it, you know, had a lot of attention. And there were other competing events there. One was one on dating, and then another one was on Egyptian hieroglyphics. And so I waited, and about, you know, hundreds of people went to one on dating, and about 100 people went to the one on hieroglyphics. And always, mine was the third one. And there was only one person who came to hear it. So, can you imagine? I was mortified. I was furious. So I went home. It was about 11 o'clock at night. I sat down in front of my computer, and in about 3 hours, I generated that that particular episode.
Oh, I've been there. I've done that.
Haven't we all?
Yeah. Actually, these days I spend most of my time online rather than talking live. But you know, I'll come up with some wonderful, wonderful story. You know, oh, this is going to get, you know, 10,000 reads in a day, and it gets, you know, 100 reads.
Yeah.
And I'll come up with some other story that, you know, I think is just a throwaway, and that's the one that gets the 10,000 reads.
Yeah, it's strange, but I mean, this is it's a different subject, but it is the world that we live in. We live in this world of hyperventilated communication where there's so many resources, and I think if you've read, this is a digression from the books we're talking about, the ones that I wrote, but it's certainly a relevant subject for today, that the mind of people have become so fragmented, and the attention span is so short, and they're so easily distracted and moving from one thing to the other, that you really can't tell what's going to attract people. And the best episode, I think, is that middle-aged, that kind of dumpy Scottish lady who sang I Dreamed a Dream and got on YouTube and became an instant success. I don't know where she is now, but, I mean, that's our world. And it's a different world. Maybe it certainly has a lot of advantages. If you look at, I can get onto Google and do a search and find something extraordinary in a second. It's dazzling. And on the other hand, find that there are 237,000 similar strikes that you can have on the same subject.
Right. There's one more little vignette from Lost and Found that I really think needs exploring. The infamous Independence Day.
Oh, yeah. Well, that tells you another thing that I felt about the Jewish community particularly, but I think it's relevant to the entire American community. The Tea Parties aren't much different. Where Independence Day, I mean, it's the Independence Day for the State of Israel, and people were somewhat distressed at the thought that a person who should also speak would be a Palestinian Israeli. It's again people think in rather kind of confining ways and provincial ways. But Mendel, the hero of this book, is a guy who's completely open and always sees the other side. That was just his way of saying that there's more to Israeli independence than that the experience of the Jews. But it was whimsical too, I think, wasn't it? As are so many of the other.
Oh, indeed it was. I mean, you know, the shock and horror that, oh my goodness, we're going to have an Arab speak to us on Independence Day.
Yeah, and then the other, a similar related subject was when they bring a refugee to the community, and he turns out not to be a refugee from the Soviet Union, but from Vietnam, and
right.
I don't know with that either.
and actually, I don't know if I read this correctly. It's not even clear that they're actually Jewish.
Oh, you mean the refugees from Vietnam?
Right.
No, they certainly aren't. But they're refugees, and that's the point.
I mean, you know, much of the book is very, very serious, but, I mean, much of the book is just fodder for giggling. You've done a wonderful job. It's a great exploration of the human psyche.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I think that it is in the tradition of Mark Twain and Sholem Aleichem, people who held us up as who we are, but at the same time in the way that we could laugh at ourselves instead of being embarrassed about it and still recognize the truths that the writers were trying to communicate.
I know I'm going to be taking you back more than 30 years here, but where did the idea for Lost and Found actually come from?
It's a good question. I think that, as I said in the beginning, I was always kind of interested in in my grandmother's hometown, because it was a place where I spent some of my time as a child. So I began looking at that community as a way of exploring these bigger issues. And then they just sort of opened. Once I got the idea of Mendel, the principal narrator in the book, it all began to come to me. And this is something very strange about writing fiction. I'm not sure everybody has that experience, but I certainly did with this book. Once the concept that I was going to do something about this little town as a microcosm of humanity, and once that character defined himself, everything just began to communicate to me as if I just had my antenna up and all these things were just coming into my head. And it was kind of an amazing experience.
All right, so you said earlier in the show that you're not the kind of person that says, I'm going to write for 2 hours a day.
Exactly.
You know, you write when something comes into your mind. I'm guessing that you sat down one day, not with a computer, because, well, maybe with a computer, 81.
It was a primitive computer, but it was a computer.
Right. And you started writing, and you really didn't know where the story was going to go.
Absolutely. That was absolutely correct in this book. I mean, in contrast to the other two, which are very, very tightly structured novels where the outlines and all the characters were there. With this one, it was just a question of opening my mind and letting my imagination flow, and one thing led to another. Yeah, absolutely correct.
I rather like that. I don't write books, or at least not many. I write, you know, 500, 700 word articles, and I can honestly say that most of the time I sit down and I write a sentence, and by the time I'm done, I end up with a product that I had no clue that was where I was headed.
Well, there's no question. You're tapping your creative impulses, and if you knew where it was headed, why, you would be just dictating. But the fact is, you're just letting your mind free associate. And I mean, the brain is an incredible universe in which it's this most sophisticated computer that exists in the world, I think, in many respects, because it takes so much diverse information, and it is always kind of scrambling it and creating new associations from referential experience. So that's what we all do. I mean, you do it as a creative writer. I do it as a creative writer. And I think we also do it in terms of everything we do, from getting up in the morning and interrelating and over our coffee to the way in which we relate to other people, to going back to bed and then experiencing another reality, the dream world.
Look, let's talk about your other books. Your second book was Burnt Umber.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that piece of writing.
Yeah, the metamorphosis of that book was I got interested in two artists, Franz Marc and Harold Paris, and I got interested in their biographies, their real biographies, and in their art. And they actually defined, in many respects, the art world of the 20th century. So Franz Marc existed in Munich before World War I. He died in World War I, and that was something that interested me, the circumstances of his death and a notebook that he wrote during his World War I experience. And then Harold Paris was, as I said, a guy who spent most of his time in Berkeley during the Vietnam era. So I decided that I was interested in writing books about each of those guys because I saw in them incredible creativity, the fact that they related their experiences of war, both in the war and as who they were, to their work, and that they were also narcissistic, colossally narcissistic. So I wanted to tie together narcissism and creativity, and the way in which artists define their work by the life that they lead. And then the parallel episode or theory that I wanted to develop was the emancipation of women over the 20th century. So there are about seven women in the book that relate to these guys, and each one successively reflects the way in which women have come into their own independently. And the consummation, of course, are these Berkeley late 20th century women that that Harold Paris engages. So those were that was what I did. And then the structure, I took a different structure on that one. I created what I wanted to do was kind of a written museum show, a written retrospective. So you had three kinds of writing in there. One were kind of sketches, and then there were things that were more fully realized, that were sort of portraits. And finally, there were full-blown narratives, which were more like a landscape or a painting with a lot of things going on. So that was what I did with that book. And I think it kind of defined the 20th century in many respects, because it was two wars and pre-war Paris, pre-war Munich, and post-war World War II Paris, and actually experiencing during the war, and then this very, very conflict, a conflicted era that we lived in Berkeley and in the United States during the Vietnam era. So that's what I tried to do with that one. And okay. Then with If you want me to go on with Prodigal Sons.
No, let's hold off on Prodigal Son for a second.
Right.
You yourself are an art collector, I believe, or certainly an art lover.
Yeah, art collection. We do. It's mostly.
Yeah, is this where the idea came from?
No, the idea came. Well, obviously, Judy and I love art. So the first experience I had with Franz Marc was there was a retrospective of his work at the museum, and I loved his work. And then I started looking at his biography, and I thought, wow, this guy's really interesting. And so I got interested in him and said, well, I should really write something about him. And then a long time later, you know, these things take a long time to kind of germinate. Judy and I were sitting at a restaurant. The restaurateur was a celebrated art collector, and on my right, up on a shelf right next to where I was sitting, was a sculpture. And I looked over at it and I said, "Why, that's an interesting sculpture. Who did that?" Somebody said that was Harold Paris. So I got interested in him, and then that's really how the two books grew. I looked at the commonality of their experiences. I looked at the way in which they were bookends on the 20th century and on 20th century art. And then I began to find a way to tie the two together. And that's how the whole novel came about. And probably, I'd say, a 12-year process.
Wow, that I mean, 12 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
You know, other than... you know, Bayer finding the sketchbook in a bombed-out farmhouse in France during World War II.
Right.
I'm guessing the book is pretty historically accurate.
You mean the novel or the notebook?
The novel.
The novel. Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, as you know, I try to use historic basis as much as I can as the matrix for a novel, and definitely the art is accurate. The historic events that occurred in before World War I in Munich are accurate. The World War I experience that he has that's in the book is accurate and drawn from historic sources. All the stuff during the World War II and post World War II historic developments in Berkeley during the People's Park and Vietnam, that's also historically accurate. That's correct. But of course, the characters they have a historic basis, their biographical basis, but they're also moving beyond their biography. I mean, all the women, for example, except for the original wife of Franz Marc that he abandoned, as you know, on his wedding night to go to Paris to paint. She's very much based upon the real woman historically, but the rest of them in the book are all fictional. Although one of Harold Paris's girlfriends I actually interviewed. And I interviewed Harold Paris's wife extensively, one of his wives.
One of his wives.
Yeah. Right.
I like that. Your most recent novel takes us in yet a completely different direction. I mean, Prodigal Sons is an out-and-out eight-cylinder thriller. It's one of those make sure your seat backs and table trays are in the upright and locked position. Without any spoilers, what can you tell us about the book?
Yeah, again, it's dealing with the Jewish experience and the Holocaust experience, and I can say that the principal character is he's very athletic. He doesn't look Jewish. He looks more Polish. He's very tall, and a soccer player and a tennis player, and also an art historian. And the book really defines the way in which his life impacts him. And it he starts out, as you know, in the backstory, as having lost his family in Poland during the Holocaust. And he then finds his way as into the as a Jewish partisan after he tries to communicate with them or save them. He ultimately, after the war, feels that he has no place in Poland anymore. Anti-Semitism is still exists, and he goes to Palestine in the illegal immigration, takes kids there, fights in the War of Independence, and then he's empty. I mean, he just cannot relate. And so he's recruited by his captain in the War of Independence to go back to Munich under a false identity, but one that suits him very well as an art historian and curator, to kill Nazis that have escaped the denazification net. And he falls in love with a German classical pianist who's working on the Goldberg Variations. And I won't go on with the rest of the story, except that what's interesting, too, about that experience is that she introduces him to a bunch of German veterans. They think he is a German Wehrmacht veteran as well, who are trying to restore the pride of the of Germany after the war. And some of them have a different agenda, which very much conflicts with the hero's horse agenda, and so on. But what is also important, one of the others, a principal character, Hermann, is in a way the other side or the equal of Horst, because he has been changed by his experience in the war and before the war, and the two of them are each trying to cope with the new reality of their existence. So that character, as you may recall, he's very fully realized. There's no demonization of him. There, he's the counterpart of the guy who's seeking to find a new life, first of all through revenge and then ultimately through the redemption of love.
I know that some time ago we had a phone conversation about prodigal sons. I had assumed that the shadowy pro-Nazi group was based either on the Odessa or Die Spinne.
Yeah.
And as I recall, your answer was, no, it was kind of a work of pure invention, but I discovered later that it did fit the M.O. of Die Spinne.
Yeah, that was really fascinating for me, because I had to create that particular organization, and it had to be different than the Odessa people because of what they were doing. And then, as you say, I got onto the internet, and I found that that which I had conceived, in fact, existed in reality.
I think that's wonderful creativity.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a totally unfair question. I shouldn't ask it, but I will. Which of the three books is your personal favorite?
Oh, that's kind of like asking you who's your favorite child. I think that I just like each one of them for different reasons. I suppose in terms of Lost and Found, that given that that was the first one that was published, in some respects that's my favorite because it has so many different dimensions to it. And I think that it's the kind of book that if it got above the radar screen would probably have really kind of an enduring staying power. I may have told you that one of the most exciting things that happened to me was 20 years after it was published, I got an email from somebody, and I almost scratched the email. I thought it was just spam, and I opened it. And it was from somebody who had read it, and she just wanted to say to me that she had read it many, many times over, and it was one of the defining. It had actually changed her life, and she just wanted me to know that. So I said, if there's one person that has that kind of experience from the book, it makes everything worthwhile, and it also elevates that particular book to kind of a unique place in my life.
Oh, if you can change one life by doing something, I mean, it's worth doing.
Right. Yeah, it was amazing that she should write that to me after having had the book 20 years and, as she said, having read it maybe 7 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
In this wired world, everyone has a website or 25. Do you have an online presence?
Yeah, I do, but I have to say I'm not a Twitter kind of guy, and I'm, as you can gather from listening to me, I have opinions on everything, and my friends are always kind of saying that I'm engaging in one rant after another. I say, well, that's just in a different environment. It wouldn't be a rant. It would be discussion in the United States. But I don't really reduce this stuff to everyday cliches, and I don't really update my website. I do have a website, sheldongreen.net, and what's there is more depth about the three books, and it's also just coincidentally on an entirely different subject, something that I spent a few years on writing my own definition of religion and God, and so for I'm sure nobody's ever read it, but that's there for the asking.
Oh, I'll tell you what, people will read it after I publish this article.
Well, great, that's great.
But you know, put your hard hat and flak jacket on.
Oh, I love the conflict. Yeah, I'm a lawyer, so I thrive on conflict. I'm not like that the reclusive guy in the bookstore. I'm really out there. You know, I once early on became enamored of Zen, the Zen philosophy. So I did a lot of reading, and I'd sit in the garden and kind of meditate, and all very much an autodidact, not somebody who had to go and listen to a guru, because kind of I'm too iconoclastic to think that a guru was going to have anything to say to me. But in any event, ultimately, what really I liked about that the Zen experience was that there's a bunch of Zen people who don't sit around in a monastery and meditate. They take their Zen approach to life and engage politically and try to make society a better place. And so that's sort of one of my little mantras that, notwithstanding the fact that I try to be pretty intellectual and, you know, spiritual, I also figure that I really want to be out there and not make the world worse, but in some small way make it a little better. So to that extent, conflict is no big deal for me. And if anybody wants to take me on my ideas, bravo, I'm right there.
Bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on. Right?
We do need to do some shameless advertising. I mean, where can people buy copies of Lost and Found, Burnt Umber, and Prodigal Sons?
Yeah, they're all available through Amazon. And the Lost and Found would be available, too, from iUniverse. But I think the simple thing to do is just to go on to Amazon, and they can get my name, Sheldongreene. And they'll find all three of the books, and I'd love to have people read them, because it gives me a lot of pleasure. I mean, the great pleasure you get, first of all, as you know, is writing something and saying, hey, that's really good, and then the next pleasure is when people read it and say, oh, yeah, it really told me something, or it maybe in some small way changed my reality. And so let's hope that happens.
It's been my experience that, you know, different genres of books appeal to different readers, and this is likely a question that you cannot answer. You know, this is called Simon Tries to Stump the Lawyer. It's a game. Do the same people buy all of your books, or, you know, does each book have its own unique set of readers?
I think that Exactly. I think that none of those, the three books are so very different from one another, even though they have common themes, or people might enjoy things that are that they have in common, the fact that they're fully realized characters and that, that I'm trying to deal with reality rather than some attenuated caricature or some comic book thing. But aside from that, they're very different, I would say. I think, as you said, the Prodigal Sons is a thriller, but it's not quite a thriller. It has too many different facets going for it. And similarly, I think you could say that that all of them don't fit precisely into any given genre, which makes it difficult. But on the other hand, I think that, as you said, for people who read one after the other, they get something different and get some different gratification out of each book. And then I should also put a plug in the fact that the next one is going to be a standard historical novel set in the Revolution, the American Revolution.
Oh, you spoilt my next question. I was going to say, okay, you've done so many genres.
Yeah.
What's your next one going to be? A poetry book?
No, I'm not into poetry. It's called Pursuit of Happiness, and it should be out sometime in the fall. That in the darkest moments of the American Revolution.
I'm looking forward to reading that one. So I hope you'll put me on your early reader list.
You can be sure, Simon, that you'll be right at the top of the list.
On the subject of readers, what sort of feedback have you received? Do people tend to like these books?
Yeah, I mean, the people who read them just love them. I'm astonished at the reactions I get. People come back and say, oh, that Prodigal Son is just great. And I've heard that word so many times that it just makes me amazed. But yeah, and it's very gratifying. But, of course, I haven't achieved that above-the-radar screen of a lot of the writers that are mainstream and that are published over and over again and that you see a lot. So I have to be satisfied with the fact that it's a boutique group of readers.
I rather like that. Why the long time between Lost and Found and Burnt Umber?
The reality is that I've never stopped writing, but it's the publication question. It's not a question of... I'm much better at just writing than I am at promotion. I'm not sure that you're aware, but there's a whole sequence of books that I've written over my whole life, and they're all going to be published as I continue to revise them. And so I've just done the revision of Pursuit of Happiness over the last 6 or 7 months, and but it's a work that has probably been in progress for maybe 10 years. And I think you'd be interested, since you're talking about Lost and Found, that the book that will be published after that will be a sequel to Lost and Found in Mendel's same voice, and that will be published in 2012. And I'm going to do some revisions of that after Pursuit of Happiness is on the boards. So it's really not a question of a long time. It's a question rather of just when I get the books out.
The book world is basically a war zone. I mean, I view it as a white-collar Afghanistan these days. I mean, the economic climate certainly isn't helping any. The Boca company are reporting, 300,000 new titles a year in the U.S. alone.
Right.
I mean, what can an author do to climb the ladder and get noticed?
I think probably get on Oprah Winfrey probably is the best way. I've often fantasized about that, and I thought, well, if you murdered somebody, then you'd have notoriety, and then they'd publish all of your books. Or if you became some kind of notorious celebrity for doing something outrageous, then your memoirs would be published. And Because in the nature of our society, celebrity, first of all, drives things, and peculiarity. I mean, in the 19th century, people used to go to carnivals, as you know. They'd come through town, attend shows, and they would see the two-headed dog and the hairy lady and that kind of thing. And that was the sort of titillation of the imagination of the ordinary person for about 5 minutes. And that's pretty much the world we live in today. There's such an incredible overstimulation of information that it's pretty much random whether anybody ever rises to a degree of notoriety, and then whether or not that notoriety sustains itself for more than about 5 minutes. So it's just a crapshoot, and there isn't any way to deal with it except to look at the kind of little comment that virtue is its own reward, and that if you like to write and you feel you have something to say, you write, and when it's done, if somebody reads it and they enjoy it, that's fine, but you have to do it for its own sake, for its intrinsic value. You can't, if you're doing it because you think you're going to be the next John Grisham, forget it. It's just not going to happen. You're living in a fantasy world. So, but it, you know, there's another upside on that. The fact that there are hundreds of thousands of books published, even though they don't have much impact and they just kind of evaporate, it also reflects something positive that's occurring in our society, and that is that there are a lot more people who are communicating, and a lot more people who are writing and using the various media, and that's kind of a positive thing. If we, you know, just to jump to another area and look at Henry Bergson, you know, the 19th century philosopher who said, you have to look at the course of civilization, not in what's happening now, all of the horrible things, and I won't elaborate on them, but look at it over a millennium and see if human beings are getting a little better over a millennium. And I'd say that from that standpoint, that there are so many books published, there's so many opportunities for people to communicate through their creativity, that's kind of a positive side. The negative side is that it's not going to be Shakespeare because he's the only game in town.
Unfortunately, our time is up, and I will share this little gem with you before we part ways. Normally, I schedule the virtual studio for 30 minutes, and I was sat outside on my front porch with my handy-dandy little glorified electronic typewriter this morning, you know, putting together questions for you.
You're not using an iPad.
No, I'm not using an iPad. I use something called Alpha Smart Neo. It's older than dirt. It takes 3 AA batteries, and it was actually featured, or is being featured, on the front page of Wired.com today.
Wow.
But it's just a delightful little thing. It's got a full-size keyboard, and it only has 6 lines of text, but that doesn't bother me. So I was merrily pounding away, you know, putting my thoughts down on questions I was going to ask you. I brought it inside, uploaded the file to the computer, and I went, there is no way on God's green earth we can get through this in 30 minutes. So I went and quickly edited the show to an hour.
Well, and we ended up talking for an hour, and I hope I didn't talk your ears off. But, I mean, obviously, we're talking about something that I love and enjoy, and quite frankly, I just so enjoy talking with you because of your insights and your appreciation. And so, for me, it's gone as if it were about 2 minutes.
Right, yes. It's a mutual feeling. Sheldon, I really, really want to thank you for taking time out to talk with me, and I do hope that the volcanic ash goes away so that you can take your vacation.
Yes, thank you. Well, we're watching that from day to day, but obviously we're in the hands of Providence, and so we'll just, I think we'll get there, quite frankly.
Good.
You know, funny, the Icelandic, they've had such a bad rap because there are only 350,000 people there, and they had these two banks that were almost as bad as some of our American banks in wreaking economic havoc in the last implosion. And so here they are, they're kind of recovering from that and having to deal with the default and the collapse of their currency, and now they have this additional humiliation of a volcano that closes down the and costs the aeronautical industry $3 billion a day. But, you know, it used to be nice to be an Icelandic person. So.
Right. They were basically known as being harmless.
Yeah, exactly. They were actually, I think you probably know as a literary type person that they were the largest per capita group of writers and poets in the world. So when we look at the other aspect of it, we have to go back on that and give them some credit for doing really nice things.
Indeed. Sheldon, I do have to call this to a halt. It has been delightful talking to you. And I know I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you every success with your current three books, and I look forward to book number four.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye.